This is a segment from The Annex, an academic sociology-themed podcast. For more, visit us on the web at theannexpodcast.com.
So, yeah, I have been fascinated by the way in which this lawsuit that has been brought against Harvard by a group of primarily Asian American students. So basically, the lawsuit against Harvard that started out, you know, not just contending that the admissions process was unfair and actually racially discriminatory against Asians, but also, you know, including the fact that, you know, affirmative action was something that should have actually been also put on the chopping block, or should also have been put under review as something that disadvantages Asian students. It seems that the judge basically said, sorry, you got to throw out that affirmative action thing because, you know, as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, it's totally fine. So now the lawsuit is going forward without the argument against affirmative action, but with the argument that, okay, the whole admissions process at Harvard University is in many ways designed to disadvantage Asian students as compared to white students. And so maybe we just need to burn shit down. And so that's my understanding of how this lawsuit has progressed.
You know what I loved about that was they managed to pinpoint quantitatively where in the application process they were penalizing Asian students. And I guess it came in the likability ratings. So there was like a statistically identifiable penchant for admissions officers to rate Asians as less likable.
Well, it's not just likable. It's like on a key of personality trait. Yeah. So likability, but also things like courage or and I'm just like, you know, if you want to get in trouble, like you should have criteria like that in your admissions process. I'm sorry.
But isn't it sort of instructive? Like, I wonder, were everybody forced to quantify their decision-making process? Like, that's probably where a lot of minorities or groups that have experienced prejudice, they do get dinged, is in the mind of maybe somebody who's racist. They're like, great, great resume, not likable, or some type of soft characteristic like that.
So here's my thing, right? So one of the things that really fascinates me about this lawsuit is this idea that people in the public have that, number one, this is a meritocracy, and that, number two, even if it is a meritocracy, merit is whatever the hell we decide it is, right? Especially at a private institution, right? So, I mean, I interact with students all the time who are like, this was my SAT score, this was my GPA, and I didn't get into Harvard, I didn't get into Princeton. And then I ask them, and so who told you that you were entitled just because you got those two things? And that is something that, you know, I don't know. I hope that at least at the end of the day, the two things will happen, right, as a result of this lawsuit is, number one, you know, we kind of demystify, right, these institutions a little bit, and also maybe the halo, right, that is bestowed on people who get accepted to and graduate from these institutions, you know, that'll be tarnished a little bit, right? In that, and when I say tarnished, I basically just mean that, like, you know what? You're really not that much better, right, than a lot of other people, at least not just simply based on these criteria that you think are universal criteria that entitle you to a place at one of these institutions. That's number one. And then also number two, I'm hoping that in some ways we will be revisiting the admissions process to some degree. I'm just hoping that this isn't, as some people claim, just kind of a way to opening the door to ending affirmative action.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting things to say about the Harvard lawsuit. And while you were speaking, I actually looked up one of my favorite posts on my blog called The Dim Kids of the Ivy League. Okay. And the Dim Kids of the Ivy League is a blog post where I discovered that the Educational Testing Service published a report showing that a non-trivial fraction of students at Ivy League schools simply just don't belong there. And I will quote from their findings. Researchers with access to closely guarded admissions data found that on the whole, about 15% of freshmen enrolled at America's highly selective colleges are white teens who fail to meet their institution's minimum admission standards. So one out of seven kids at Harvard or Princeton simply do not meet the qualifications that are posted on the door. And later, another researcher who had done some research on Ivy League admissions policies tweeted this out about a year and a half ago, a tweet that said 41% of the freshman class at Harvard is legacy. That does not mean that they all don't deserve to be there. So maybe they were stellar students, but they also had a grandparent who went to Harvard or something like that. But I think what these kinds of research show is that there's always been a big massaging by the admissions office of who gets into highly selective schools. Probably the best discussion of this is from a book called The Chosen by Jerome Carabel, which is literally 800 pages long, big, thick doorstop of a book.
I love that
book. But is one of the most historically intense investigations of Ivy League admissions practices. And you can see during the entire 20th century history of these elite schools that, you know, there was great attention paid to the ethnic composition. Originally, it was an attempt to keep Jewish students out. Then it was an attempt to keep Asian students out. And then you discover that the admissions process is complicated. It's not just affirmative action. It's not just, you know, black admits going from, say, 3% to 5% or something like that. It's also legacies. It's also the well-roundedness criteria. There's also the docket system, which everybody seems to overlook, but which is important. And the docket system is when they don't judge each application by itself, but they judge them according to which state they were from. That was instituted in order to keep, to minimize the number of Jewish students from New York and New Jersey. So they would say, we need geographical diversity, right? Mm-hmm. So for decades, probably even a century now, we have very concrete evidence that these institutions are really massaging and shaping the people who get in. And that reminds me of a book written by a couple of ed school researchers. Leslie triggered this memory. It's called Crafting a Class.
Yes.
And the idea is very simple, which is you're an admissions officer. You can't just assign a number based on SAT. There are all these political considerations from outside the school and inside the school. And you have to craft a class. You have to have it make it look the right way for it to be acceptable. So after reading this, I realized, my God, you know, are people truly prepared for an elite college campus that would be based only on SATs and GPAs? And I tell people, for example, do you want Harvard and Yale and Berkeley and Michigan and Princeton to look like Caltech, which is now over 50% Asian, right? Or Berkeley?
And And the other thing I would add is, like, I mean, I think a large part of why you want to get into Harvard in the first place is this kind of the sort of culture and the ethos that you think Harvard represents. And that includes the ability to hobnob and rub elbows with the children of these influential people or with Natalie Portman or whatever actor or actress, right, got in that year with all of these sort of what they call development admits, right? You know what I mean? If those people weren't admitted, would Harvard be as shiny an object, right, as it is, number one? And number two, would Harvard have the money that Harvard has without actually admitting in quite a few students from very, very wealthy families, in large part because they're from very wealthy families?
Harvard might, Duke would not. So in Price of Admission, it talks about various schools, especially in the 80s and 90s, doing development admits. And apparently Duke was the most aggressive at this. And, you know, it really took them from kind of a lower ranked regional school to, you know, one of the top 20 research universities in the country. You know, with it, so, you know, I want to second that The Chosen is a great book. And, you know, I see the big theme of The Chosen is that well-roundedness was effectively an intentional, what do you call the type of, in discrimination law, adverse, you know, something that has like an indirect effect.
Right, adverse effects, yeah.
Yeah, anyway, it was that by design, right? That they deliberately tweaked it because most of the
disparate impact.
College presidents. Yeah, disparate impact. Thank you. Yes. Exactly. Yeah, so it was disparate impact by design. Right. You know, where, you know, most of them were not willing to have overt quotas to restrict Jewish enrollment, but they tried to find other ways to effectively get to that outcome. And that is fundamentally why we have well-roundedness. Although, you know, I went back about a year ago and reviewed The Chosen. And one of the things that struck me was actually how brief the period of open meritocratic admissions was, where it was, you know, so there was this very brief period where, so originally, you know, for like 200, 300 years, the Ivy League was based on, you had to come from certain prep schools and you had to speak Latin and Greek. And then they dropped the Greek requirement and started offering things that were kind of early precursors to the SAT. You still had to speak Latin, right, but at the time, most good public high schools taught Latin. And they found that there was this huge influx of Jews, and that period lasted something like 10 years. It was really short. And then after that, they started saying like, well, we need to make sure we have enough kids from Montana, and we have to make sure that, you know, we have kids who are, you know, basically almost explicitly, just like this current lawsuit, you know, that who have a good personality, who represent, you know, club men and, you know, all that sort of thing. So it was a very brief period that it was basically all test scores. The other thing I would talk about is like, I believe as Fabio mentioned, oh, here's this percentage of kids with low SATs and here's this percentage of kids who are legacies. For my money, the best work on comparing all the things systematically that go into admissions was Espen Shade and Chung. And then a follow-up article by Espen Shade, Chung, and Walling. Because actually, this is how you do it. You just take all these things, you throw them in a logit, and you see what the coefficients are, right? I mean, we wouldn't settle for crosstabs or anything else because we know that some of these things are correlated with each other and everything like that. And it turns out that all those things matter, right? You know, your high school GPA matters, your SAT matters, your race matters, and specifically they found that blacks are get the most have the highest log odds of getting in, controlling for everything else, then Latinos, then whites, and then Asians are below whites. You know, that is, so they had evidence that relative to whites, Asians are discriminated against by the admissions process, holding everything else constant. There's also an athletic bonus and there's also a legacy bonus. If I remember correctly, I don't have it right in front of me, the legacy bonus was a little bit smaller than some of the race or athletic bonuses. And they did the math, and then in the second article, the one that had Walling on it, I think it was the one that had Walling. One of them had, anyway, the second article, they did kind of a predicted simulation type thing where they just took the coefficients and said, what if you got rid of affirmative action but kept legacy and athletics? What if you got rid of all three? You know, and they found that what would end up happening in this kind of, you know, just based on SAT and GPA type world, the counterfactual is that the number of whites would stay about the same, the number of Asians would go way up, and the number of blacks and Latinos would go way down. And that does seem to be the logic that you see reflected in the Harvard lawsuit, that framing it as effectively affirmative action is bad for Asians, which is consistent with what Espen Shade found. Although there's a big caveat there in that Espen Shade published that stuff about 15 years ago, and the data is from about 20 years ago. I believe it was the 1997 entering cohort.
Yeah. So I really love Gabriel's point about how, you know, going to a straight GPA kind of numerical system would provide a certain profile. And that, and compare that to Leslie's comment saying that, you know, part of the privilege of going to these schools is you get to hobnob with the right people and you get the social connections. And, you know, in response to that kind of observation, I once wrote an article called "Do You Want a Meritocracy? You Can't Handle a Meritocracy." And, you know, I tell people like, is Harvard willing to go into a world where like 55% of its students are Asian or something like that? you know.
Or is Harvard willing to go into a world where you get points deducted because possibly part of the reason why you have such a high SAT score is because your family has a lot of money and has been able to afford to help you figure out how to get really high test score, right?
Test
and a lot of that, and a lot of this has to do with, you know, how do we define merit, right? And if merit is, right, your SAT score, then how do we then do a better job of trying to predict what actually goes into your getting a high SAT score? There's some people who get high SAT scores because they're just really good test takers. There's some people who get high SAT scores because they've been going to like the shadow school system since they were in second grade. There's some people who have high SAT scores because their parents have been able to, you know, sort of surround them with educational material and culturally rich materials in their homes the entire time. So, I mean, I think all of that goes into like, why is the SAT the holy grail of what constitutes a meritocracy? And if that's what it is, how much of that merit can that individual student claim as having won for themselves? And how much of it has to do with their family?
Go ahead.
Yeah. So a couple points on that. Number one, you're implicitly defining merit as the residual. Right. You're almost saying, like, let's figure out how well you did in high school, what goes into your college application essay, and then we're going to control for your family background and then find the residual. And this is like your willpower or something like that. And I see the logic of that. Like, if you're trying to figure out who made the most with what they're given. But on the other hand, if you're just saying, like, who has the most accomplishments at a certain point, it kind of doesn't matter where they came from. And that's like a deep philosophical thing. Do you want to look at the residual or do you want to look at why? Now, in terms of this... because you're a sociologist and a good one, and particularly, you know, education, you're not doing the thing I often hear from people of like, oh, it's all test prep. Test prep accounts for like 30 SAT points. It's nothing. You know, but my real thing with this is people talk about how the SAT is correlated with family income, which it is. It has a fairly high correlation with family income, as if everything else didn't. You know, right. As if, you know, you founded a nonprofit while you were in high school is not a sign of extreme privilege. And by the way, one that is much easier to buy than a high SAT score, right? You can pay you can pay for all the tutors and that sort of thing to send your dumbass rich kid to SAT prep. And they're still going to get, you know, 1100 points on the SAT because the tutors only account for about 30 points. But you can very easily go to a college admissions consultant, have them set up a charity in your kid's name, collect some checks from your friends, and have them, you know, work at a soup kitchen for 2 hours a weekend for, you know, the 3 months before application. And that's like something that you could just flat out buy.
And write your essays as well.
Yeah, and write your essays as well. So like I fundamentally see it as this logic of you're never going to get away from class reproduction, ever. The only thing I've ever seen, the only circumstance I've ever seen where you can get away from class reproduction is during the Chinese Cultural Revolution, class background as an intellectual had no advantage for getting into college. Class background as a party cadre did, but they admitted the kind of upper middle class intellectual professional class advantage. Now, I'm not saying like, oh, anyone who cares about inequality is a malice. That's not my point. But I'm saying like that is the only circumstance, which is an extreme circumstance, like basically a collapse of civilization type circumstance where you could eliminate class reproduction. Anything else, any criteria you could come up with, the upper class will game it, right? If you say we think SAT is correlated with class with background income, which it is, so we'll switch to, you know, how much charity did you do as a high school student? That's ridiculous. That's easy to game. It's trivial to game. All the well-roundedness stuff, if anything, is much easier to game than the test scores.
You know, I was reading the Times article and listening to what you say, and I'm wondering how much of class reproduction is a bug as opposed to a feature of these high-end schools. Like I remember in the Times article on this, the article was talking about how Harvard admissions counselors were wary of admitting a lot of engineers or computer scientists because they would probably end up opting to go to MIT or Caltech. And those are more skills-oriented types of degrees. And a lot of the programs that we're discussing deal in humanities and soft skills, where maybe the transmission and acquisition of cultural capital and social capital is what's being sold ultimately. So it's like, is Harvard about selling skills and amassing the best? Or is it is what it's really selling connections and the aura of being a Harvard graduate?
Yeah, let me take a moment to also step in. That's a great point, and to defend the SATs a little bit. So I agree 100% with Gabriel that they're probably the hardest thing to game amongst the things you might include. But also the other thing to remember is that we do actually care at least a little bit about what people do in college, right? Like when they show up, we want them to be able to pass their classes and have an enjoyable academic experience. And of all the things we have, SATs are actually the best predictor of that. A lot of academics think that SATs have no predictive validity for college performance. That's actually not true. What they do is they predict the first year or so of your college experience pretty well, which kind of makes sense, right? Because you take them in your last year of high school, your first year of college is still kind of similar to your high school program. And then later on, the effects go away. I'm not sure why, but my theory is that people just sort into the majors they're good at. But the point is, you know, if you actually care at all about people doing well academically, you know, doing well on a standardized test is probably not a crazy way to do that. Not only is it harder to game than the other stuff, but in terms of validity, like there's a lot of research, like letters of recommendation have no predictive value in the future at all. They just don't. And so,
well, at least they're not time consuming to write.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Fabio, I'm not trying to say that the SATs don't have any predictive validity. What my understanding, though, in the studies that I have shown is that there's actually a cutoff point, right? After which, 10 more points, 50 more points, 100 more points doesn't offer you greater predictive validity, right? So this idea that you can just take the average scores of a certain group and say, well, this group on average, did better. And so hence, they're being penalized for it. I'm pretty sure, and I say this from actually having been on at least one admissions committee myself, is that there is there's generally a floor that they have where they say, okay, at this point, we think everyone who did this well and above, we're putting them in the same pool, and then we'll see what else they have to offer.
Yeah, that's a pretty valid point. And, there's no a priori reason to say, there might be a threshold effect or a hurdle effect, and to say maybe what college admission should be really something like, we're not going to accept anybody below a certain cutoff, but beyond that, we look for other things. And once again, I'm still a little wary because even though, there may be cutoff points for SAT tests, that's still better than letters of recommendation or some of these other signals. I think the question is always what's the alternative? What is the thing we would do instead of this? And they all have costs. And as was pointed out, if you go to an all GPA standardized test score format, you'll get too many engineers. And that produces one kind of class. And if you want people who will be in the future elite, that produces another kind of class. And maybe this gets back to an earlier section of this podcast, which is when you're running an institution, you have to ask what your goal is. And you can't do everything. You can't produce the best engineers in the world at the same time as you're producing the world's social elites. Those are incompatible in most cases.
For more, visit us on the web, theannexpodcast.com.